And we'll pass out the attendance sheet. And we get to study Psalm 105. At the beginning of your notes at the top on page 241, I put a fairly lengthy quote from Stephen Lawson because I thought it was so good. And he says, "World history cannot be understood apart from God's invisible hand upon redemptive history." So we have a parallel. We have world history going. Redemptive history is the story of God's providing salvation. The course of world events cannot be grasped without observing God at work in and through his people. Here is the hinge upon which all history turns. God is always working through his people to affect the flow of the entire world. This is the beauty of Psalm 105. It is one of three historical psalms in the Psalter, the other two being Psalm 78 and 106. These historical psalms chronicle in summary fashion the high points of the sacred history of God's people in the Old Testament. In Psalm 105, we see the invisible hand of God upon the many events, circumstances, movements, and causes of history. We see God not distant and far removed, but up close, actively involved in the affairs of men, the events of nations, the rise of rulers, the course of kingdoms, and the direction of history. Psalm 105 and 106 form a perfectly matched pair. Psalm 105 tells how God treated Israel, and conversely, Psalm 106 tells how Israel treated God. In these two psalms, the double theme of the entire Bible is summarized: God's salvation and man's sin. Psalm 105 is a call to God's people to worship the Lord because he rules over history. And I think you're going to enjoy the psalm as we go through it. Now, it has no superscription, nothing on top that tells us who wrote it or so on. Some people believe that David is the author, and the reason is when you compare verses 1 to 15 with 1 Chronicles 16:8 to 22, that's 1 to 15 in Psalm 105, with 1 Chronicles 16:8 to 22, that 1 Chronicles passage is a song that David wrote. There's no doubt about that. So many people think that would be evidence that he wrote Psalm 105. Our outline is by Peter Stevenson. And we begin with one, the praise of the mighty God. That's in verses 1 to 15. And we begin with the exhortation to praise. So calling on us to praise. And verse 1, "Oh, give thanks to the Lord. Call upon his name. Make known his deeds among the people." So we are exhorted to give thanks. And by the way, that's first of 10 commands that are in the first verses here. There's a command, command, command. The first one is to give thanks. And we give thanks. Well, second command is to call upon his name. We give thanks and then we bring our requests to him. Make known, the third command, his deeds among the peoples. So we're to give him praise, we're to make our needs known to him, and we're to tell other people about him. Verse 2, sing to him, sing praises to him. Speak of all his wonders. The wonders in Scripture are the mighty deeds that God has done that cause people to be filled with wonder and with awe at him. And those are his wonders. And so there's the wonders that God has done in Scripture for us to tell people about. And then there's the wonders that he has done in our life. Verse 3, glory in his holy name. Let the heart of those who seek the Lord be glad. We are told to glory, that means to boast in the Lord. Instead of boasting in what we have done, we are to boast in what he has done. So glory or boast in his holy name. And let the heart of those who seek the Lord be glad. They will never find, we will never find, lasting happiness in material things as much as we try. I mean, what a time to learn that lesson at Christmas. But the true happiness, the lasting happiness, comes to those who seek Him. Now that term, those who seek the Lord, is a term that's referring to believers. We are told of the non-believer in the book of Romans, quoting the book of Psalms, there's none that seek after God, none that seek after righteousness. But when we know the Lord, that's a different thing. That we have a desire, and our heart's desire is to seek Him. Hold on to Psalm 105 and turn back to Psalm 42. I think Psalm 42, the first two verses, are just a great commentary on the believer seeking the Lord. Psalm 42, verses 1 and 2. Verse 1, Psalm 42, as the deer pants for the water brooks. And where David lived a good portion of his life out in the wilderness, especially when he was hiding from Saul, there are some springs and there are some streams, but you get very far away from the streams and you don't have green vegetation. It's out towards the Dead Sea. And they have lots of deer out there. And the one time that we hiked to En Gedi, which is where one of those streams are that David spent a lot of time with, the one time we hiked to En Gedi, we saw a lot of the deer that were called ibex that were around there. Well, they get thirsty. It gets hot at the Dead Sea. And as the deer longs for the water brooks, so my soul pants or longs for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God, when I shall come and appear before God. So for the believer, it is true that we seek the Lord and we long for fellowship with Him and we enjoy that. And we go and we have that fellowship with Him. And yes, He satisfies, but at the same time, we long for more. And that's the command that is here to in Psalm 105, to sing praises, speak of His wonders, glory in His name, and let the heart of those who seek the Lord be glad. They're going to find He gives lasting joy. Verse 4, seek the Lord and His strength, seek His face continually. His strength, instead of trusting ourselves, we are trusting in His strength. We have a project to do that we just wonder, how are we going to do it? How are we going to get through the day? How are we going to obey Him? And so on. And we draw on His strength. Paul said, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And then we seek His face continually. The more we seek to know Him, the more we want to know Him. And it goes continually, continually, continually. Verse 5, remember His wonders again, which He has done, His marvels, and then it says, and the judgments ordered by His mouth. Psalm 105 was written, when you come right down to it, to help these people, and in turn us, remember His wonders, but also His marvels, and then His judgments uttered by His mouth. The idea is He simply speaks judgment and it comes about. And in verse 6, we're going to meet Abraham. Abraham saw firsthand some of God's judgments, the judgment of fire and brimstone on Sodom and Gomorrah, the judgment on the 10 kings that came and captured his nephew Lot, and so on. That brings us to turn the page to page 242 with the fulfillment of the covenant in verses 6 to 15. We have so much to give thanks for, including His fulfillment of the covenant. O seed of Abraham, verse 6, his servant, O sons of Jacob, his chosen ones. Out of all the peoples on the face of the earth, God chose Abraham to make a covenant with him. It's one of the most important moments in Scripture is when God made that covenant with Abraham and with Abraham's descendants. And the connection with verse 5, as I said, Abraham saw the wonders of God and he saw the judgments of God firsthand. But here he calls on, O seed of Abraham, his servant, O sons of Jacob, his chosen ones. And of course, the sons of Jacob are the 12 tribes of Israel. And they are his chosen ones and his chosen people. And that covenant, we're going to see, is an everlasting covenant. He will never throw away his people. He will never say, I'm finished with you. He's disciplined them, but he never says, I'm finished. Verse 7, he is the Lord our God. His judgments are in all the earth. But in the midst of those judgments, has he forgotten Israel? No. Verse 8, he has remembered his covenant forever. That is, the covenant with Abraham and Abraham's descendants, the Jewish people. Now, the idea is that a covenant is a promise made by God that he does not take lightly. And remember, the covenant was made in Genesis 15 with Abraham in a ceremony where Abraham took a number of animals, sacrificed them to the Lord, then cut them in half, half of the animal here, half of the next animal, half there. And it was the custom in those days, it was the way people made agreements together, that the two people making the agreement would walk down the middle through the split animals. And the idea was, if I go back on my word on this covenant, may it happen to me what has happened to the animals. And what happened to the animals? They were killed. So it was a very serious thing. But then after God had Abraham sacrifice the animals, set them out, he put Abraham to sleep, and God walked through there all by himself, which was a message being sent that the whole condition of the covenant rested upon God. That as long as God keeps his word, that covenant will be in effect. Abraham and his descendants may not keep their word, but they were asleep. And God took the full responsibility. And then, of course, that covenant had to be instituted by the sacrifice of those animals. So there is the shedding of blood, which is a picture of Jesus instituting what was promised to the Jewish people as the new covenant. And when Jesus is in the upper room with the disciples the night before the crucifixion, and he takes the Passover and he takes the wine, he says, this is the new covenant in my blood. So just as there was blood for this covenant, it's a picture and a reminder of the ultimate blood, the blood of the sinless Passover lamb, the Lord Jesus, who shed his blood for us. So there's a lot of symbolic and picture meaning in what God did with Abraham. So he has remembered, verse 8, his covenant forever, the word which he commanded to a thousand generations. Now, a thousand generations is a long time. In 70 AD, which of course is almost 2,000 years ago, the Jewish nation was destroyed. Jews were dispersed. How many generations have gone by since 70 AD? Well, it's about 60. 60 generations, God has not forgotten the Jewish people. He's brought them back to their land, and many Jewish people are coming to Christ and so on. But 60 generations is a drop in the bucket compared to 1,000 generations. And so the 1,000 generations is a poetic expression of forever. It's eternal. God has commanded and will keep his covenant forever. This is the covenant, verse 9, which he made with Abraham. Again, that man that not because of anything that he had done, but by God's grace, he called him out and chose him. And his oath to Isaac. Now with Abraham, he made the covenant with Abraham. Abraham was the one that cut the animals and so on. And Isaac never saw that. But God made an oath to Isaac. He made a promise to Isaac that Isaac was the next generation of that Abrahamic covenant that God had made with Abraham. Then verse 10, likewise, he confirmed it to Jacob for a statute, to Israel as an everlasting covenant. Jacob, of course, being the son of Isaac. Now, it mentions here about being a statute. So you have the covenant, you have the oath, and then with Jacob, he uses the term statute. This is referring back to the experience that Jacob had at Bethel when he was leaving the promised land, fleeing from his brother, and he had the dream of the angels ascending and descending on the ladder, the staircase. And when that was over, God made a promise to Abraham that he was the heir of this everlasting covenant. And the term that's used here is statute. That is the idea of a law. And the idea is that this covenant is just like a binding law. The laws of the United States are binding on the citizens of the United States. This law that God made concerning the covenant is binding on God. And then he made it to Israel, which is Jacob's new name. He made it to Israel as an everlasting covenant. When God changed Jacob's name, he didn't change his covenant, is what this is saying. In fact, in Genesis 35, 9 to 12, God is going to reiterate the promise of the covenant to Jacob when he is talking to him about his new name, Israel. And Jacob, of course, had all kinds of fears just before this, that he and his family are going to be wiped out by his brother Esau. When he came back from Laban, he thinks Esau still is seeking revenge. He's going to kill me. And then Jacob learned that Esau was coming towards him with 400 men. He was even more convinced that Esau was going to kill him. And so it was an interesting timing that God repeated the promise of his new name and then gave that promise that the covenant is still in effect and he is going to protect him. It's an everlasting covenant. Verse 11, saying to you, saying that is to Jacob or with the new name Israel, to you I will give the land of Canaan as the portion of your inheritance. And of course at the time that God said that to Jacob, he only owned two pieces of property. He owned what he had inherited from Isaac, who had inherited from Abraham, the family burial tomb at Hebron. And then Jacob, just a short time before this, had bought a portion of property in a place called Shechem, where there is a well and where he settled. But it's just a small piece of property. He didn't. The whole land of Israel was completely out of his reach. But here's the promise. It will be in effect to him, that is, through his descendants. Verse 12, God made this promise to you, I'll give the land of Canaan, when they, that is Abraham and his sons and their families, were only a few men in number. That is a great reminder that the promises of the covenant are not dependent upon the number of Abraham's descendants. If the number of Abraham's descendants ever got down to just one, like Abraham, the promises are still in effect, and it will never be less than one. Now, it's never gotten down to just one since then. But this is interesting to see the timing of this whole connection with Jacob, because it refers to when God reiterated the promise of the covenant, when he reminded him of his new name. Because just before that, we happened to be in the passage Sunday night when Jacob's daughter Dinah had been raped by the sons of Shechem. Revenge was sought and carried out by two of Jacob's sons. And Jacob, when he learned about that, was horrified. And he said, they're going to come after me. They're going to come after us. The rest of the Canaanites might wipe us out because of what you have done. And God, because he's seeing we're just a few people compared to all the Canaanites. But in this verse, God says, when they were only a few men in number, very few and strangers in it, Jacob and Isaac and Abraham were nomads. They went from this place to that place. They didn't put down permanent roots. And they were considered strangers in the land, or foreigners in the land of the Canaanites. And God says, yet despite the fact that you get to be few in number at this point, despite the fact that you're foreigners, you're not owning the land yet, the promises are there for you. Verse 13, and they wandered about from nation to nation, from one kingdom to another people. Don't get the idea that the nation to nation is like wandering from Italy to Turkey to Greece and so on. It's used of the different nations of the Canaanites. So it's all in Canaan, in the promised land. And so as nomads, they were over here with the Hittites and over here with the Hivites and over here with the Amorites and so on. They had no permanent dwelling. But then verse 14, God says, here's an example of how I have protected you because of the covenant. It says, of God, he permitted no man to oppress them, and he reproved kings for their sake. He permitted no man to oppress them. No one could harm them unless God allowed it. By the way, that's a good principle throughout the Bible concerning God and his people, whether it be the Jews, his people, or the New Testament believer, his people. He permitted no man to oppress them. What this particularly is talking about, though, is in Abraham's day, there were some times, and in Isaac and Jacob's, when people wanted to do them harm, and God wouldn't allow it. The next part continues that, and it says, and he reproved kings for their sake. That refers to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He reproved kings for their sake. What kings would that be? For instance, there was the Pharaoh in Egypt. Remember when Abraham went down to Egypt and then Sarah almost got taken into the harem of Pharaoh, and God rebuked Pharaoh to stop him from taking Sarah to be his wife? That would have been devastating to the line of the Messiah. He reproved Pharaoh. Later on, same kind of thing happened with a Philistine king named Abimelech. God reproved Abimelech. Later, he's going to reprove another Abimelech. Abimelech, probably a title like Pharaoh, that was about to do the same thing with Sarah, with Isaac and Rebekah. He reproved kings for their sake. Therefore, verse 15. The reason I put the therefore is verse 15 is a verse that occasionally you will hear people refer to, and I think usually they take it out of context. Now, maybe you can stretch the application to the way that they do it, but have to be careful. Here's the verse, verse 15. Do not touch my anointed ones, and do my prophets no harm. Occasionally, you will hear someone quote that verse to warn people, don't criticize an evangelist, or don't criticize a pastor, or don't criticize someone who's in some kind of ministry. It's especially used with television evangelists and so on. If they begin to get into some hot water, they've done something wrong, and someone is trying to expose that, inevitably someone will quote verse 15. Don't touch mine anointed, as it says in the King James Version. That's a dangerous thing to use the verse that way, because there's a whole lot of verses in the New Testament which tell us, you know, there's people that need to be watched, and there's some false prophets out there, and so on, and they need to be exposed. So it's not right to hide behind verse 15. Well, what is verse 15 talking about? Well, it's in the context of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the patriarchs we call them, and God protecting them, and when someone like the Pharaoh or the Abimelech was going to do them harm, God reproved them. God stopped them. That's the context. So the anointed ones specifically that he's referring to are the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, I think there's room to make some application of that to the Jewish people as a whole and so on, but specifically it's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he says, and do my prophets no harm. You say, but Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob weren't prophets. Well, in a sense, they were. Let me share that with you. Abraham was called a prophet in Genesis chapter 20, verse 7. And guess who called him a prophet? It was God. God tells Abimelech, when he is reproving Abimelech concerning what he wants to do with Sarah, he tells Abimelech that Abraham is a prophet. So the term prophet applies to Abraham. Isaac is never called a prophet, but he served prophetically in the sense that something that he did was a prophecy of Christ, and that is when he went with his father up to Mount Moriah, laid on the altar, and gave himself to be the sacrifice, but then, of course, was spared. And that becomes a great type, we call it, a type of Christ, God's Son who was taken and was offered as a sacrifice for us. So in that sense, he served prophetically, and then he gave prophecies of his sons in Genesis 27, 37 to 40. Likewise, Jacob, in the role of a prophet, foretold the future of his sons in Genesis 48, 13 to 20, and Genesis 49, 1 to 28. Genesis 48, 13 to 20, and 49, 1 to 28. So the bottom line is, verse 15 is talking about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as the anointed ones. So what this is, it's a reminding us of God's commitment to the covenant, and that he would not let his people, the Jewish people, be wiped out from the very beginning, when there were just a few of them with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, all the way to the present and beyond. Well, turning the page, we come to page 243, and we have the mighty, the work of the mighty God. And we have A, the preparation through Joseph. So you see what's happening. We're working through Israel's history. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, now Joseph. Fascinating character, Joseph. So in verse 16, look at this. I mean, I was struck by this verse this morning. And he called for a famine upon the land. He broke the whole staff of bread. Notice that God calls for a famine. And this is the famine that caused Jacob's sons to go down to Egypt to get food. When Joseph had been down there and learned they were going to have a famine and provided for having enough provisions to take to last during the famine and so on. This is the famine that it's talking about. But I like it how it says that God called for a famine. Famine wasn't just an act of nature, quote unquote, or an accident or something. I mean, this was the direct intervention of God. God can do that. He called for a famine, and it's as if calling for a servant, and the servant says, "Yes, sir," and does it. There is the famine in the land. Now, the land here would refer to the land of Canaan, the promised land. And God had a plan using that famine to get them down to Egypt for 400 years. Why do they need to be in Egypt for 400 years? Well, in God promising the covenant to Abraham and in promising the land of Canaan to Abraham, he said, your descendants are going to be down in Egypt for 400 years. The reason they're going to be in for 400 years is to let the Canaanites alone. Leave them here by themselves. And they're just going to be left to themselves, and their wickedness is going to be demonstrated. They want to be wicked. And they're just going to get more wicked and more wicked and more wicked to the point that there will be no question but that they should be destroyed. Which is then what Israel did after 400 years, comes back to the land under Joshua and conquers the land. And God said, destroy the Canaanites. He had given them 400 years. And instead of repenting and so on, they just got worse and worse and worse. So all of this is being worked out in the plan of God. The famine is the means to get them down to Egypt. So he called for a famine upon the land. And then the New American Standard translates the next phrase, he broke the whole staff of bread. Now, bread is called the staff of life. You know, that's an old, old expression. And that's probably why the New American Standard translators translated it that way. But I like the English Standard Version translation a little better, where instead of the staff, it says the supply of bread. And of course, the idea is that bread is the basic food. And under a famine, when your meat is gone and your vegetables are gone, usually at least you have some grain and you can make some bread. And bread is usually the last thing to go. And that's how bad the famine was. But in verse 17, again, the work of God. He called for the famine, and he sent a man before them. Now, it's interesting. If you had told Joseph's brothers when they were angry at Joseph, if you had told his brothers, God's going to send Joseph to Egypt, there they would have said, no, 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 no. We sold him as a slave. And he just happened to go to Egypt. Two different perspectives on the same event. But which is the number one perspective? It's God's perspective. God was at work through this, including the sin of the brothers of betraying their brother and selling him like a slave and lying to their father and so on. So he sent a man before them, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. Verse 18. They afflicted his feet with fetters. Now, and he himself was laid in irons. These two lines in verse 18 have no reference in Genesis. Nothing in Genesis about Joseph's feet being in fetters or being in irons. Does that mean it didn't happen? No. This psalm is inspired scripture. And this was inspired. It's an added detail. It probably was an oral tradition that was handed down from generation to generation. The generation of Joseph handed it down to the next generation and so on. And it was preserved and so on. But then God, in his inspired word, included it because it is true, even though it isn't in the book of Genesis. It certainly could have been. I mean, you read Genesis and you don't see any reason why you would think that this wasn't true. It just doesn't mention it. But so here his feet are chained up in fetters. And he himself was laid in irons. Now that little phrase has had an interesting history of translation. The Hebrew is the word neck. Why the New American Standard translated it the way I did, I don't know. I'm sure they had a good reason. I would love to know what it is. They were very careful in their translation. But I do not know what the reason was. The Hebrew is the word neck. And the English Standard Version says, his neck was put in a collar of iron. Now here's something else in the history of the translation of this verse. For some reason, what we call the Septuagint. The Septuagint was the Greek translation of the Old Testament that the Jewish scholars, a couple of hundred years before the time of Christ, most of the Jews spoke Greek instead of Hebrew. So at the time of Christ, the most common used translation of the Hebrew Bible for Jewish people was the Greek Septuagint. And Jesus quoted from it, the apostles quoted from it, and so on. For some reason, the Septuagint translated neck as soul. Well, then, Jerome, you may have heard the name Saint Jerome. He came along 200 or 300 years after the time of Christ. He's famous for translating the Hebrew Old Testament and the Greek New Testament into Latin, the language of his day, which was a good major step in the chain of translation, that the Bible would be translated into the language of the people. But for some reason, Jerome, when he came to this phrase, he inverted the subject and the object and said, instead of the Hebrew reading, his soul was laid in iron, instead of the way the Septuagint translated it, his soul was laid in iron, instead he wrote, iron entered into his soul. Now we have no idea why he did that, but part of the irony of the English language, that got picked up from Jerome and put into the English Book of Common Prayer, which for several hundred years has been so important to the Anglican and Episcopal Church. That then came down into American English as kind of an idiom about iron in the soul. And it all comes from the mistranslation of this verse. That's probably more than you wanted to know about it, but I found it kind of interesting. So all of that to say that the translators have done some funny things with that verse. But anyway, here's Joseph. He's a slave in Egypt. You remember how he was sold by his brothers to some traders, slave traders. They take him to Egypt. They sell him to Potiphar. He's a servant in Potiphar's house. Potiphar's wife accuses him tries to seduce him, and then when he resists, then she goes to her husband and tells the opposite, he tried to seduce me. Potiphar puts him in prison. So here's the man who's going to be the savior of the Jewish people, and he's in prison, and he's in fetters, and he's in chains. Verse 19, until the time that his word came to pass. That is, Joseph, while he's in prison, remember, a couple of the servants of the of the Pharaoh are down there in the prison, and they have some dreams. And he interprets the dreams, and they come about, and so on, and all of that leads to his being released from prison. And that was in God's time. Until the time that his word came to pass, the word of the Lord tested him. He went through trial. We think we've been through trials. Most of us have never been through something like that, where we're falsely accused, thrown in a dungeon to rot day after day after day after day. Talk about testing. He was tested, but he was faithful. Then verse 20, the king sent and released him. The ruler of peoples, and set him free. He made him lord of his house and ruler over all his possessions. You remember the story, how Pharaoh had a dream, and he interpreted that dream, prophecy of the famine that was, first the good years of plenteous harvest, and then a famine, and so on. Pharaoh was so impressed when it began to happen, he puts him in authority over everything in the kingdom. Only one who's higher is Pharaoh. That's what this is talking about. Made him lord over his house, verse 22, to imprison his princes at will. In other words, he who was once a prisoner has the authority to put others in authority in prison. I mean, what a change. Now there's people, a prime minister, say, or a governor, someone of that stature. Joseph's over them. He would have the authority to put them in prison. It's not saying he did. It's saying he had that authority, and what an irony it was. And that he might teach his elders wisdom. Elders would refer to Pharaoh's counselors. And he gave them wisdom in explaining to them about the 7 good years that were coming and the 7 lean years that were coming. That brings us to B, the deliverance of Israel. So God's preparation through Joseph, now the deliverance of Israel. Verse 23, Israel also came into Egypt. That would be referring to Jacob. That's Jacob's new name. That's not referring to Israel the nation, but Jacob the person. Israel also came into Egypt. Thus Jacob sojourned in the land of Ham. Land of Ham is another name for Egypt. And he caused his people to be very fruitful. The he there is capitalized. It's God. And God caused his people, God's people, the descendants of Jacob, to be very fruitful and made them stronger than their adversaries. Stronger in numbers. Remember, then Pharaoh gets worried. He sees the Hebrews multiplying so, he's afraid they're going to take over. And so he makes them slaves. Verse 25, he turned their heart to hate his people. So God is at work in this. All of this is working towards the deliverance of the Jewish people. He turned the Egyptians' heart to hate God's people, the Jewish people, to deal craftily with his servants. Verse 26, he sent Moses. So he sent Joseph. Now he sends Moses, his servant. Moses and Aaron didn't volunteer. They were commanded. They were commissioned. You could say they were roped into this job. So he sent Moses, his servant, and Aaron, whom he had chosen, and called them to this job. In verse 27, they performed his wondrous acts among them. You know what the wondrous acts are? The 10 plagues of Egypt. Turn the page to the supplemental notes, and I forgot to put that in mine, so I'll get it from these other notes here and put it in my notebook. A little chart here from the Bible Knowledge Commentary, and it lists the 10 plagues and the order in which they happen, the reference. But then, this is good. The third column, it says, possible Egyptian gods and goddesses of Egypt attacked by the plagues. When you know about the gods and goddesses of Egypt, and then you look at the plagues, you realize, in a way, God has a sense of humor here. These plagues were not just random. They were an attack on these so-called gods and goddesses that the Egyptians were so involved in worshiping. And so God, through the plagues, is showing that the gods of the Egyptians are impotent, powerless, can't do anything. Someone has called the 10 plagues the battle of the gods. You have the God, and then you have the idols, the false gods. So every one of these plagues demonstrates that. Well, turning back to the notes, that then applies to what's happening in the next few verses. In verse 28, after they performed his wonders and acts among them and miracles in the land of Ham, verse 28, he sent darkness and made it dark, and they did not rebel against his words. He's going to list some of the plagues, not in the same order in which they happened, but a number of the plagues are here. The plagues showed God's power over the gods of Egypt, such as when you look at the supplemental sheet, there is Ra, the sun god, most important of Egypt's gods. But he's suddenly banished from the land when everything turns black, turns dark. And he sent that darkness, made it dark, and they did not rebel against his words. Verse 29, he turned their waters into blood and caused their fish to die. The waters would be primarily the Nile River. And there was Hapi, the god of the Nile, Isis, the goddess of the Nile, Hunum, the guardian of the Nile, and so on. And they were all impotent when the Nile is turned to blood. And then he caused their fish to die. The fish were a large part of Egypt's food supply. And it would be tragic in their minds to see dead fish just floating all over the river. But that's what happened because of the power of God. Verse 30, their land swarmed with frogs. You remember that one? Frogs were everywhere. Frogs were in their ovens. Frogs were in their beds. Frogs were in their ice chests. Wherever they were, there were frogs. And then it says, even in the chambers of the kings. So even the pharaohs had to contend with this. Verse 31, he spoke and there came a swarm of flies. And many insects were identified with gods and goddesses to be worshipped, including flies. Turning the page to page 284. In verse... I forgot about the gnats in verse 31, and gnats in all their territory. King James Version in Exodus calls the gnats lice, so we more often call this the plague of the lice. And they were all over. Verse 32, he gave them hail for rain and flaming fire in their land. Now, it does not hail in Egypt. And it barely rains. There are parts of Egypt that do not see rain year after year after year. And yet all of a sudden, God brings this storm. Can you imagine how disturbing that would be to the people? And then they get hail. Hail's going to destroy the crops. They have gods of the crops. And these gods are impotent to handle this. And then flaming fire, that would be the lightning that comes with the storm of the hail. And because of the hail in verse 33, he struck down their vines. All their hope of gathering a harvest from vines and fruit trees and vegetables and so on are all gone. He struck down their vines also and their fig trees and shattered the trees of their territory. Verse 34, he spoke and locusts came. Kind of like creation in Genesis 1, 6 days of creation. God spoke and the heavenly bodies were there. God spoke and this happened and that. He spoke and the locusts came. And young locusts, even without number, that are very hungry. And they ate up all vegetation in their land and ate up the fruit of the ground. He also struck all the firstborn in their land, the firstfruits of all their vigor. And of course you remember that that was the straw that broke the camel's back. Some of the other plagues afterwards, Pharaoh said, oh yeah, please leave. But then he changed his mind. But when it came to the death of the firstborn, Pharaoh, and I'm sure the rest of Israel was all in, or the rest of Egypt was all in agreement. Get those people out of here. And so, the death of the firstborn, verse 37, God's still working. Then he brought them out, brought the Jews out of Egypt, with silver and gold. You remember what happened? Moses told them to ask their Egyptian neighbors for gold and jewelry and so on. It was their wages for being slaves. The Egyptians were so glad to get rid of them that they gave them everything just to get them on their way. And then that gold and silver and jewels are going to be used later for building the tabernacle and the parts of the tabernacle and so on. So he brought them out with silver and gold. I mean, here they've been slaves and they leave rich. And among his tribes, there was no one who stumbled. In other words, that night when they left Egypt and they headed for the Red Sea, and there had to be some elderly people among them, for instance. There had to be some people who were sick. But God miraculously enabled them to keep up with everyone. And they didn't fall, they didn't stumble, and so on. They all got out. It was miraculous by God's power. So, verse 38, and Egypt was glad when they departed, for the dread of them had fallen upon them. Egypt wanted nothing more to do with the Jewish people. And God's prophecy to Abraham 400 years before was fulfilled, that the Jews were down in Egypt and they would leave and go back to the promised land. Well, that's a good place to stop at the stopping time.